Hello, everyone. Welcome to this very special live recording of my podcast with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest, Matt Ridley. Matt, welcome to the show.
Brendan, it's great to be back on your show. I hugely admire everything you do and everything Spike does.
Well, we're huge fans of yours. I'm delighted to have you on, especially for the live recording, so that the audience can also get to ask you some questions as well. I've got a million questions I want to ask you. I'll try to squeeze them into the hour we have. Of course, I want to start with something you've been writing about over the past couple of years brilliantly in your book, Viral, The Origins of COVID-19, and also in numerous articles and essays, including for Spite. I want to ask you about the lab leak theory, the possibility that this virus, COVID-19, that brought the entire world to a standstill for a period of time, the possibility that it came from a laboratory. It's such a fascinating theory. Every time I read about it, I feel like I think to myself, am I being a conspiracy theorist? All these ideas are washing over me. It's starting to sound really convincing. And I do find myself increasingly intrigued by the possibility that's where this virus came from. So I want to start off by asking you where your thinking currently stands. Where is your mind right now on that fundamental question of the origins of COVID-19?
Well, of course, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a cock-up theory, you know, almost by definition. We think it was an accident if that's what happened. I've moved steadily from being originally someone who dismissed the idea in the early months. I didn't think biotechnologists were good enough to do this kind of thing, and I thought the evidence was against it. The more I looked into it, the more I saw the evidence against a lab leak collapsing and the evidence for it getting stronger and stronger. We're not there yet. It's not 100%, but I think it's very likely that this is what happened now. And there is such a determined attempt in the scientific establishment not to admit that, not to debate that. I cannot get anybody to debate me on the subject from within the scientific establishment. I can't get organizations like the Royal Society to debate it, etc. The most important event of our lifetimes, frankly, 20 million people dead, possibly due to probably due to something that went wrong in a laboratory, and nobody wants to talk about it. This is outrageous and disgraceful. And so for me at the moment, the issue is how to get the scientific conversation properly going within the pages of Nature and Science and within the Royal Society and the Academy of Sciences in America and so on. That's where we're battling to.
Yeah, I think the absence of debate, or rather the suppression of debate about this fundamental question is so striking. And I definitely want to come back to that in a moment. But let's talk a little bit about the evidence. You know, whenever I read something by you on this in particular, I just think to myself, this sounds very convincing, or at least like a very convincing scenario, a very convincing possibility. You know, there are numerous pieces of evidence now that do point to a laboratory origin. I think my two favorite, or the ones that I use in conversations with people, are firstly that, you know, the world-class laboratory on bat origin viruses was in Wuhan, and that's where COVID-19 comes from. And also, it was a very infectious disease in human beings, which is quite unusual for a disease that allegedly leapt from an animal into human beings. It does seem to point to the possibility that it might have been manufactured in such a way as to spread through human beings or impact on human beings. So those kinds of pieces of evidence I find really, really fascinating. But could you just give us a breakdown of what you think is the most convincing evidence for this theory, and what you think, why you think it's increasingly likely or possible that that's where it comes from?
Yeah. Well, there are two kinds of evidence. There's a positive evidence and negative evidence. So the negative evidence is the general collapse of all the alternative theories. So the idea that it got there on frozen food from abroad, the idea that it was an animal in that market has basically pretty well been debunked. That we've seen another hole below the waterline in one of the papers claiming the market was the source today in terms of strong evidence for ascertainment bias. In other words, the only reason the early cases are near the market is because the only way you could get diagnosed with COVID in the early weeks was by living near the market. If you lived further away, they refused to diagnose you as having COVID. So it's a completely circular argument. So that's the negative evidence getting weaker all the time. The positive evidence, as you say, the extraordinary coincidence of geography, of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the worlds, this virus walks into the one town, the one city. You know, it doesn't turn up in Wolverhampton or somewhere like that. It turns up in Wuhan, the one city where there is a huge, bigger than anywhere else in the world, research program on bat-borne coronaviruses, particularly sarbecoviruses of this kind, SARS-like beta coronaviruses. As you say, it's ready to go out of the box. It is extremely infectious to start with. It doesn't need much in the way of mutations to adapt to human beings. That suggests it's been in human beings for a while. It's better adapted to human ACE2 receptors than to any other type of animal ACE2 receptors, including bats. The only exception to that is monkeys, which it's also pretty good at infecting. So those are two lines of evidence. But the strongest line of evidence now, and the one that swayed my co-author Alina Chan, a brilliant virus expert at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, that swayed her most strongly and me, was the appearance of a document in September 2021 called the Defuse Proposal, which was an explicit proposal for scientists in the US to collaborate with the Wuhan Institute of Virology to collect yet more sarbecoviruses from bats, manipulate them in the lab, infect them into humanized mice, and test how dangerous they were. And to save money by doing this at biosafety level 2, which is a low and risky level of biosafety. But what was most extraordinary about that proposal was that, and we've now seen earlier drafts of it, which confirm some of the details, was that it specifically said that they would put a thing called a furin cleavage site into the spike gene of a sarbecovirus if they found one that didn't have this in it. Now, no sarbecovirus has ever turned up in the world with a furin cleavage site in its spike gene. And that's true to this day. Of the over 800 types of sarbecovirus that we know, not one of them has a furin cleavage site except for SARS-CoV-2. And actually, just I've got a visual aid here. This is what a furin cleavage site is. This is a cushion, but on it is the sequence of a bunch of viruses in the key part of the spike gene. And you can see one of them is rather different. It's got this huge insertion, this chunk of about 12 letters of genetic code added that others haven't got. Now, that's pretty well exactly the sequence that the scientists were proposing to add to a sarbecovirus for the first time. Now, they were turned down for that grant application by the Pentagon, but they reconvened almost certainly to ask for the same money from the National Institutes of Health. And at the same time, there was a big new grant from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which we think probably went to this work. So there's every likelihood that they made this kind of virus. And the final bit of evidence that just strongly hints at something having happened in that lab, they had a database of all the viruses they were working on. It went offline in September 2019. It's never come back online. They refused to release it. If it didn't have relevant viruses in it, it would exonerate them in a flash. But they refused to release it.
I mean, when you lay it out, as you just have done, including with the aid of your brilliant cushion, it does sound extraordinary and very convincing, at least very, very interesting and worthy of serious consideration. But the other thing that really gets me about this discussion is that if you ever raise it with people, certain people, the people who are determined to poo-poo the idea from the very beginning, they will say, you know, you're crazy, you're talking nonsense, this kind of thing doesn't happen. But this is another argument you make. This kind of thing does happen. And you've made the point that when there was an anthrax outbreak, for example, in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, it is not a coincidence that it was down the road from a Soviet bioweapons factory. And likewise, when there was a very minor outbreak of smallpox in England in the 1970s, I think one person got infected. That was as a consequence of a smallpox laboratory. So diseases do escape from laboratories. And lo and behold, in history, we've had situations where diseases that are being studied in a particular laboratory tend to break free into the local area. So there is a precedence for this, isn't there? These things have happened, and yet we have this situation where some people will look at you as if you're mad if you even raise the possibility.
No, lab leaks happen all the time. Now, this doesn't mean that all labs are risky all the time. It means there's a lot of labs out there doing a lot of experiments, and a very small percentage of them will have accidents, and those can lead to pretty disastrous results, as you mentioned, the anthrax one. The most similar example, in a way, I think, is the outbreak of foot and mouth on a farm in 2007 in Pirbright in Surrey, just 13 miles from the world's leading reference laboratory for foot and mouth virus. Now, that wasn't a coincidence. It turned out that a contractor had mended a leaking pipe at the lab, and he'd then gone to work on the farm, and he'd taken the virus with him. This lab is 8 miles from where the first cases appeared of this disease. So the coincidence is even more striking. And by the way, SARS, the close cousin of this disease, the one that broke out in 2003, sorry, I've got my years wrong. It started in the end of 2002 and it was eradicated in 2003. But by 2004, there had been lab leaks that infected people in Beijing at least 4 times, in Taiwan once, in Singapore once. And in all but one of those occasions, they didn't know how it happened. So they didn't say, I dropped a test tube, I punctured a glove, something like that. They just know that a researcher working on that virus picked it up. Now, that's not a very infectious virus compared with this one. If this one was in a lab, it would be very, very easy for a researcher to get infected. So, it's not at all implausible to talk about lab leaks. They do happen. They're a big issue. We had the World Health Organization before the pandemic, they won't say it now, saying this is one of the major possible sources of the next pandemic. So it's wrong. For some reason, early on, people sort of said the default hypothesis is that it couldn't have come out of a lab and you have to prove that it did. I don't think that's necessarily right. The default hypothesis should be that it could well have come out of a lab and you have to prove that it didn't.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of putting it and looking at it. I want to ask you, who was doing this work in Wuhan? Because I think sometimes when I talk to people about it, they have the mistaken view that what we're talking about is a bunch of sinister Chinese scientists, or perhaps even some people might think we're talking about amateur Chinese scientists who made all these cock-ups, made all these mistakes, and then the world is suffering as a consequence of what they did. But America was involved too as well, wasn't it, in terms of the work that was being carried out, the way in which it was being funded, the questions that were being raised. So could you say a little bit about who was involved in this work at the Wuhan laboratory?
Yes, the key team was led by a researcher called Xi Zhengli, who's a very, very experienced researcher, and she was the person who tracked down really the source of SARS some years earlier. And she had a very big lab with some key people in it, people like Peng Zhu and Ben Hu, who were doing the experiments under her in the lab. And somebody called Yu Ping, who was responsible for finding the viruses in caves elsewhere in China. Now, Yu Ping and Ben Hu are two of the people that, according to US intelligence, got really sick in the fall of 2019 and had to be hospitalized with respiratory infections. So it's quite possible that we're looking at patients zero and one there, and one other name also about that time. But they were being funded mostly by the Chinese Academy of Sciences. They were not bioweapon researchers at all. Their motive was to predict and prevent the next pandemic, right? Well, that didn't turn out particularly well, if that's what they were trying to do, because they certainly didn't predict it. And their motive was to say, to go into the field, find viruses in bats, come back and say, this one's dangerous, that one isn't. And we've done experiments with mice to show that. They got a lot of funding from something called the EcoHealth Alliance, which was a nonprofit based in New York, run by a Brit called Peter Daszak, himself on $400,000 a year, by the way, all of his money was, pretty well all of his money was coming from the US government, from the National Institutes of Health and other sources. And he was effectively a conduit for funding, for channeling money from the US to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, this was a time when the particular kinds of gain of function experiment on potential pandemic viruses was under a moratorium for federal funding in the US, and included in that was coronaviruses. So it was quite convenient that they were able to continue the same kind of work in Wuhan. Now, the experiment, the particular experiment Xi Zhengli's labs was doing were pioneered by a man named Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina. But the bats, the horseshoe bats that these viruses live in, do not live in the Americas. So Baric had to rely on Xi Zhengli for sources of bat viruses from this particular group of viruses, the Sabica viruses.
Before we get on to the subsequent discussion about the lab leak theory, or even rather the lack of discussion or the avoidance of discussion, I want to ask you about the initial response when COVID-19 broke out late 2019, early 2020, it really starts to spread. In those early days, there was some acknowledgement, wasn't there, at some level that this was it was possibly a result of what was being done at the Wuhan laboratory. I'm not saying that people were in, you know, American scientists or Chinese scientists were out in public waving the flag and saying, look, we did it. But there were people were talking to Anthony Fauci, the science guy in America who oversaw so much of their COVID lockdown strategies. Scientists were saying to him, at least in a private capacity, that it's possible this comes from Wuhan. It's possible this is a consequence of some of the work that we've been funding and some of the work we've been involved in. Was there an early recognition that it was a possibility it came from the lab, which was subsequently suppressed? What was the initial response when they heard about this outbreak?
Yeah, well, this is, it's almost worse than you say, because we now know through messages and emails that have been released, Slack messages and emails that have been released through Congress, that a group of virologists were discussing among themselves the strong possibility, once they'd seen the genome of the virus, that it was something out of the lab, because they knew it was so close to the kind of things they were experimenting on in that lab, which happened to be in the same city where the outbreak was happening. And this group was convened onto a teleconference on the 1st of February 2020 by Jeremy Farrow of the Wellcome Trust and Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease scientist in the US. And during that meeting, they discussed the real possibility that this was a lab leak. Some of them said they were 80-20 in favor, others 50-50, and so on. By the end of the meeting, they'd agreed that they would write an article discussing this possibility. But within 2 days, that article had changed into one dismissing the possibility. And we don't entirely know why. At first, they thought, oh, we found that the pangolins were involved. That excuses the lab. Turns out it doesn't. The pangolin virus doesn't have a furin cleavage site, is not nearly similar enough, et cetera, et cetera. It's a red herring. But they went on drafting a paper, which was published in March, saying we can rule out the lab leak. But we've got their Slack messages from throughout that time and from later, right into April. And they are still saying, I still think it probably was a lab leak. So they'd written a paper and published it in Nature Medicine, which influenced me, among other people, which said the exact opposite of what they thought in private. Now, that for me is scientific misconduct of a significant scale. The paper should be retracted, and the issue should be seriously investigated. You do not publish a paper saying, I can rule out this hypothesis, when you privately think it's likely. I'm sorry, that is just not the way a scientist should behave. Christian Anderson, the lead author on the paper, has exchanged emails with one of his colleagues about this during this period, in which they said, it's a shame we have to get political. So the reason for doing it was purely politics. They didn't want to upset China. They didn't want to give succor to the Trump administration, etc. Now, you know, that's not science as I was taught to do, scientist, when I was a biologist.
You might have already answered this question, and maybe it's an obvious question as well, but I want to ask you why they did what you just described, why they went from having these private conversations on Slack and in emails right up to April 2020, as you say, where they entertained the possibility that this came from the Wuhan lab, to then issuing statements and articles saying, nope, it didn't, you know, stop your nonsense. You say it's political. Was there an element of back covering as well, or back covering the possibility that they were involved in this? Because I read a piece recently which said, look, if it's true that this came from the Wuhan lab and that this work was funded in part by and involved American scientists, then this is surely one of the worst acts of gross misconduct in human history. And it's difficult to disagree with that. Do you think there's an element where they were just kind of covering their backs in response to what was became a very terrifying virus that spread with extraordinary speed and killed millions of people? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, some of these scientists had a vested interest in concluding that it couldn't have come from a lab. Peter Daszak had funneled funding to Wuhan. Xi Jinping obviously had done these experiments. Tony Fauci had aggressively defended gain-of-function research and the funding of it, etc. But others like Christian Anderson, Andrew Rambo, Eddie Helms, Robert Gary, the main authors of that paper, I said, didn't have that particular skin in the game. So what was their motive for writing something that they didn't believe? As I say, I think the evidence suggests it was political. When the paper was published, Christian Anderson sent a triumphant email saying, that's my most high-profile paper yet, tenure secured, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. So in other words, you know, in terms of pure ambition, doing something that Anthony Fauci approved of would be very helpful for his career. Now, you can go a little further down a conspiratorial rabbit hole and note that the very day, 2 days after that teleconference, Anthony Fauci took time out of his busy schedule handling the pandemic to have a conversation with the head of a Chinese, with one of the senior managers of a Chinese property company called Evergrande, which was dangling the prospect of giving $115 million to Harvard Medical School. And the head of our Harvard Medical School said it would be helpful if he could have a chat with you, Mr. Fauci, before he finalizes the donation. Was that a conversation along the lines of, we can't give this money if you're wittering on about a lab leak? I don't know. Why not come and tell us what that conversation was about, Dr. Fauci? That would be helpful. I don't know whether that stands up as a motivation or not, but I'm sorry, we are now in the realms of having to ask all these questions because an opportunity was missed right at the beginning of this process for science to come clean and say there's a risk this has happened, it shouldn't have, we'll learn some lessons from this, we'll not do these kind of experiments at biosafety level two, and we will clean up our act. And then the reputation of science would be fine. As it is now, having defended them to the last ditch, when it does finally emerge, as I suspect it probably will, that this did come from a lab, the whole of science is tainted. All those professors who have either refused to put their heads above the parapet in terms of taking a stand on this, or have thrown really quite nasty abuse at those of us who are arguing that this is a question that needs to be tackled.
I wanted to ask you about science, actually. You mentioned there science's reputation. I think you give a very good description of what may happen to it once more information about the origins of COVID-19 comes out. And I just wanted you to say why you're so interested in this issue, because I think there are probably some people out there who have this mad scientist view of what was taking place in Wuhan and who have taken a mad scientist view of lots of things that have happened during the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. You know, we've seen anti-vaxxers, for example, and people saying, well, you can't trust the medical establishment, you can't trust science itself. You know, laboratories are full of these rather zany, crazy people doing things they shouldn't be doing. But you, of course, are a great defender of science and the extraordinary contribution it has made to human existence and the improvement of human existence. You've written about that at great length in your books over the years. So for you, it's not about denigrating science, is it? It's rather the opposite. It's about giving science an opportunity to, as you say, come clean and repair its reputation in front of the world's eyes.
Exactly that. I'm a passionate champion of science as a philosophy, less so of science as an institution these days, but that's a different question. And not only that, I've made a particular, you know, the topic when I was in the House of Lords that I most often put down questions about was biotechnology in agriculture and other forms of biotechnology. I'm dead in favor of using genetic engineering for the good of mankind. So I don't come to this debate with an anti-genetic engineering bias, quite the reverse. And indeed, I found myself with some strange bedfellows in this debate, because one of the organizations that's been pushing for freedom of information releases around this topic is US Right to Know, who are anti-GMO campaigners. I wouldn't normally break bread with people like that if I could help it. But on this issue, I have gradually found myself driven into the position of being on the same side of the debate as them. So this isn't about joining a bandwagon against science. Quite the reverse. I'm really terrified that this episode will hugely damage the reputation of vaccines, the reputation of GMOs, all these kind of things. But I think it would damage it a lot more if science kept digging in its heels and saying we can't even discuss the possibility. The more they do that, the worse the damage is to the reputation of science.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, let's talk about the suppression of discussion on the lab leak theory. It takes many different forms. I mean, there was open censorship for a period of time, you know, on social media in particular. If you put forward the lab leak theory, there was a real risk you'd be kicked off Facebook, you'd be kicked off Twitter. I mean, there was, in the pre-Musk era anyway, there was this enforcement of online censorship against people who wanted to entertain this possibility and talk about it. And then there's also more informal forms of censorship. You know, there are no doubt scientists out there and maybe political actors as well who know that there could be consequences for their reputation if they raise questions or push certain arguments. So it takes many different forms, but it's very palpable form of suppression. You know, if you think of Michael Gove, for example, at the COVID inquiry in the UK here, he raised the possibility of the lab leak theory as something that should be looked into, and he was basically told to shut up, you know, pipe down, we're not covering that, we're not talking about that. And that is very often the attitude. How problematic do you think that suppression was? I mean, I think, firstly, it's always bad to suppress discussion, in my view, but I think it also contributed to a broader unwillingness to really grapple with this question about the origins of COVID-19. And had the impact that censorship always has, which is to, you know, push us into the darkness, remove the kind of the light of reason and truth and examination and questioning, and put on the blinkers and say, well, this is the truth as decreed by Fauci or someone else, and you don't have to think about it anymore. It was a really destructive approach to this question, wasn't it?
It really was. You're right that Facebook censored any conversation about the lab leak in 2020. Twitter didn't, actually. Twitter turned out to be vital because those of us who were interested in this question were able to find each other, and some extraordinary, brilliant amateur individuals made significant contributions to finding relevant theses inside China and things like that. But there was a breakthrough in May of 2021 when the extremely ham-fisted World Health Organization inquiry into what happened in Wuhan backfired. They held a press conference which endorsed the theory that it might have got there on frozen food as more likely than the lab leak. That was so farcical that it had the opposite effect of what they intended. And that had the effect of flushing out some scientists to put their heads above the parapet and write a letter to Nature saying, you can't rule out a lab leak. It needs to be properly investigated. And suddenly the dam opened in terms of being able to talk about it in the media. A lot of mainstream media organizations went back and re-edited articles they'd written, saying it was a debunked conspiracy theory and things like that. And others allowed the conversation to happen for the first time. But gradually they closed it down again. And over the last couple of years, it's again become the case that the New York Times, the BBC, and other organizations like this just won't discuss it fairly at all. They will make, there was a thing on the BBC today, which described it as a crazy conspiracy theory again. So the lid is closing gradually again, and particularly the lead given by the major scientific publications, Science and Nature and other ones like it, is really shockingly biased and one-sided. Now, we saw an example of that this week. There was an attack on two scientists who've been very vocal, saying that the lab leak is probable and dangerous and fraud was committed and people should be held accountable. They've been perhaps a little too fruity in their language at times, so, you know, maybe they could calm down a bit. But these are Richard E. Bright and Bryce Nichols at Rutgers University. Now, they were attacked in the form of a letter from, I think it was 13 virologists, saying, it was to their boss at Rutgers University saying, please silence these guys. They shouldn't be saying what they are. They're being rude about us. They're using nasty language. We're quite happy to engage in a civilized debate with them. Engage in a civilized debate. Some of the authors of this letter had been using four-letter words and other appalling smears against, you know, people like my co-author, a young postdoc at MIT. So the hypocrisy there stinks. But of course, Science magazine then wrote an article about it saying these two professors have been rude and making no mention of the fact that their detractors had been even ruder. So, this sounds like a storm in a teacup, and it is, you know, it's a little spat within science. But it just shows how the lengths to which some people want to go to keep the lid on this debate and to suppress the free speech of other professors included in this, but also journalists who want to debate the topic.
Listening to you say that, it makes me think that this is another aspect of this discussion that is fundamentally anti-science, because surely if science is to thrive and to do the things that it should be doing, which is to discover things and understand things and in its application, potentially improve people's lives, you need the broadest discussion possible. You need pretty free, robust debate. You need to be able to falsify things, disprove things, try to prove things. You need that really rigorous approach to trying to understand the natural world, trying to understand how things work, why things work. So when you have a situation, which we see in many different areas of science and social policy in recent years, where people basically say the science is settled, this question is settled, it's fixed, we know the truth, we don't need to talk about it anymore. That's a real problem, not only for public life, but also for science itself, isn't it?
It certainly is. The way science has progressed, and it has progressed magnificently over the last couple of centuries, is by being decentralized and having challenge. You know, so Professor A in Oxford tells Professor B in Cambridge that he's talking nonsense. That's a vital part of the process, because otherwise Professor B will go off down a rabbit hole of confirmation bias and motivated reasoning that may blind him to contrary evidence. So you've got to have a process of challenge. And somewhere in the last 40, 50 years, we've moved to very centralized funding of scientists through, in the UK, it's UKRI, in the US, it's the National Institutes of Health and organizations like that, where there's only one view imposed by a really monolithic process reinforced by peer review of grants that enforces a dogma. And more, that is turning science into an organization that resembles the Catholic Church before the arrival of Luther. I exaggerate, but only a little.
Okay, I want to touch on another issue with you as well, Matt, something you've been writing about a lot over the years, which is the climate change question, the issue of science in relation to climate change as well, the issue of scientific debate, public debate. And I want to start off by asking you about net zero. Because net zero seems to me to be a pretty good example of a word you just mentioned there, which is the word dogma, where what you have is a real problem in the world, climate change, environmental pollution, those issues that people are rightly concerned about and do exist. And scientists have a major role to play in understanding what those problems are, where they come from, how they might be addressed. But as you will know more than many, over time, that's turned from a theory or a problem to be talked about into a dogmatic approach to social policy, public life, how things should be done in society itself. And net zero is a good example of that, where you go very speedily from a theory that the climate is changing, possibly as a consequence of human behavior, through to this dogmatic, religious, pretty zealous idea that unless we slash carbon emissions by a very specific amount, by a very specific year, we're headed to hell in a handcart. So how do you stand on the net zero question? Do you think that's an example of the problematic use of science that you've been talking about?
I absolutely do. I am not a denier. I've never denied climate change. I've been writing about climate change for 40 years now. I covered it when I was science editor of The Economist in the 1980s. And I was more alarmed about it then than I am now. Most people have gone in the other direction, become more alarmed today. It's a real phenomenon. It's an important issue. But I've never thought that it was it was so important that no cost was too great for tackling it. That can't be right. What we've done with the UK's approach to net zero is embark on a process of deindustrialization and suppression of innovation and consumer preferences in pursuit of mostly very inadequate technologies for tackling the problem. You know, if we want to tackle the problem, let's go nuclear. You know, that's the only way we're going to have our energy in a reliable and affordable form. The renewables just can't cut it. You know, they are too inefficient, too intermittent, too unreliable. They need too much space. They need too much materials, etc. So the idea that you go straight from saying climate change is a problem to saying wind energy is the solution feels to me wrong. But when we adopted the net zero target, we did so with ridiculously little discussion. I was in Parliament at the time, and I made this point in a speech in the House of Lords saying, you know, sorry, 1 hour of conversation about this is not enough. Where is the cost-benefit analysis? And there wasn't one. And I, you know, Lord Deben, the head of the Climate Change Committee, was sitting in the chamber at the time, and I said, you know, please stand up, interrupt me, show me the cost-benefit analysis. And he remained in his seat. So it seems to me that we are embarking on a very, very, very expensive technological and energetic exchange that will do real harm to the environment for what could be very little benefit. It's like taking chemotherapy for a cold.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. The thing that strikes me, and I know that you've been thinking about this for a long time too, is the apocalyptic language that always attends these discussions. And you said earlier that, you know, science is on occasion behaving like the Catholic Church in the years before Luther. In this instance, I think that's actually not an exaggeration, because if you look at the apocalyptic language that surrounds the issue of climate change, some of it comes from scientists, but a lot of it comes from social activists, the political class, the media elites as well. You know, they will take a certain prediction and they will turn it into an instruction from on high that unless we change our behavior, there will be floods, there will be plagues, there will be heat, you know, there will be a heat apocalypse is essentially what they're saying. And that kind of very apocalyptic language, to my mind, that has nothing to do with science whatsoever. And that has nothing to do with your correct observation that climate change is a real phenomenon and it's something worth investigating and talking about and addressing. The apocalyptic predictions, they come from something else, don't they? A different urge, a kind of a desire, I guess, among certain sections of society to fantasize about end times in order to make themselves feel a bit more important about the things they do in everyday life to try and make those end times not happen.
Well, I think you're right that there's an apocaholic, as I a phrase, a word that I quite like, feature to all this, very similar to the preachers of the 16th century who said the end is nigh. And if you take just one example, storms, everybody thinks storms are getting worse. Everybody thinks more people are dying as a result of storms. There is no evidence that storms are getting worse. The frequency and intensity of tropical cyclones and of temperate region storms shows a lot of year-to-year variation, but no trend over 30 years, upward or downward. That is not me saying that. That's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I'm the one who's sticking with the consensus here. You know, the people who say, oh, it's, you know, the storm we had last month was, but you know, couldn't have happened without climate change. They're the ones departing from it. And as for the number of people killed by storms, that number has plummeted in recent decades. Why? Not because weather's got less dangerous, but because we've got better transport, better communication, better warnings, better shelter, things like that. So that's how we should tackle the storms. They're all going to be, you know, whether, if even if we stopped all carbon dioxide production tomorrow, there would still be hurricanes. You know, there've always been hurricanes. In fact, there's some evidence that there might be slightly fewer in a warmer world because there's less difference between the warmer and the colder parts of the world. But I won't go down that area. But the motivation to compete to produce the most scary rendition of the climate change scare. You know, you see it at the BBC, where they now talk about heating, not warming, and they talk about the climate emergency or the climate crisis. There's a deliberate attempt to hot up the language. You see it at Extinction Rebellion, when they talk about billions of people starving to death in the next 10 years or something like that, which is, by the way, you know, we're in a period where fewer people are starving to death than ever before, where agricultural productivity is massively up, partly thanks to extra carbon dioxide in the air, partly thanks to a little more warming, and partly thanks to technological innovation. So I really worry about the preaching of doom, which has always been a feature of human civilization. It's nothing new about this. We've been doing it even when we think things were going well in the 19th century. The most popular authors were the ones who said it's all about to come to a shuddering halt. But the preaching of doom, to the point where people are not having children because they're worried about the future, is highly irresponsible and wrong.
Yeah, and I think anyone who wants more information on how things are getting better, they should read some of Matt's books, especially The Rational Optimist, which I often look to for nuggets of wisdom and a good feeling in otherwise insane times.
They're getting better, except that I'm losing these kind of arguments. So maybe they're not getting better in that sense.
we'll persevere with the arguments and see how far we get with the public. Matt, one more question I want to ask you before I start bringing some audience questions in. A couple of things happened over the past 48 hours, which I think are just very interesting. The first is the coke ovens at Port Talbot Steelworks stopped. They closed for the last time. So that's done and done. That's history. And also, there are reports of a very large spike in poverty in the UK, a lot of it down to the energy crisis and the fact that people's bills are going through the roof and they're struggling to make ends meet. And of course, people talk about the impact of the Ukraine war in relation to the energy crisis, which is no doubt true, but there are other factors as well. And I just thought those two stories were interesting, because surely it's commonsensical that in a country that doesn't take its own domestic production of energy seriously and doesn't venture down that road in a very serious, ambitious way, there are going to be energy crises. There is going to be the possibility of greater forms of poverty. We're not pursuing nuclear, as you mentioned, in the way that we should be. Try to open a coal-fired power station and you'll have protesters there for years and years. Everything has to go through the Climate Change Commission, which, you know, shakes its head in fury at anything that might interfere with net zero obligations. So isn't it time that Britain really took seriously its ability and capacity and duty to produce energy here at home in order that people can have a more abundant life?
Yes and no. I'm enough of a free trader to believe that we should get the cheapest energy we can find wherever we get it from. If it's cheaper from abroad, let's get it from abroad. But in the case of gas, which is the mainstay of our electricity supply, and we have the most expensive electricity for industrial users in Europe, and that's some of the most expensive in the world, and that's why the coke ovens are closing and so on. So we are making it very hard to be competitive. Energy is an absolutely vital part of every industrial process. Gas is a big part of our mix, will be for decades, is the cleanest of the fossil fuels in terms of carbon. So it doesn't make sense to cut us off from gas supplies. But there is no world market in gas. Gas is so expensive to transport that the cost can vary hugely between different parts of the world. So it's about one quarter to one third of the cost in America as it is here. Now, we could have changed that overnight 10 years ago by adopting the shale gas revolution, which revolutionized American gas production and drove it from being a declining gas producer to a major exporting one. And they're exporting it to us, but it's expensive. If we dug it out of Lancashire, where the Boland Shale is, it would become very cheap. It wouldn't be cheap immediately, but the price would come down rapidly. That's what the evidence elsewhere in the world suggests. It is extraordinary that we turned our back on this very, very rich supply of gas, much richer than most of the shales in the United States, and decided that we wanted expensive energy, a lot of it from overseas, instead. So we're not only reducing our energy security, we're also increasing our energy price. And that feels to me completely wrong, even if you think that we need to find a way to get to net zero.
Okay, Matt, I'm going to ask you some questions from the audience of Spiked supporters. The first one is from Steve. I'll be really interested to hear what you think about this. He says, after everything we've learned about the ineffectiveness and damaging consequences of lockdowns and mask mandates, do you think the authorities are likely to pursue those policies in the future?
I think it's really important that we fight this battle, that we get it on the record in the public arena that these policies did not work well. Look at Sweden, look at various US states, look at the excess death rate in the UK, things like cancer and heart disease because of lack of treatment, look at the effect on schools, and look at the failure of lockdowns to work, particularly the last attempted lockdown. Do you remember in December 2021, we were told we needed one more lockdown for the Omicron variant? The Omicron variant was highly infectious. Lockdown wouldn't have worked anyway, and far, far fewer people were killed than the models suggested. So, what we should have done in March of 2020, 4 years ago, this week, as it were, is we should have said, get outside, have your meetings outdoors. We now know that in the outdoor arena, you are 18 times less likely to get the virus than in an indoor setting. Do everything you can outside, go indoors with other people as little as possible. Up to you how you do it, but that's the way to do it. Voluntary, not compulsory. And that would have, I think, been a far more effective policy. But we have to win that argument.
And it's another good case of suppressing discussion being wrong. I mean, it's good that there's now a COVID inquiry. But what I find really fascinating about the post-lockdown period is there's almost a kind of national amnesia. You know, people, lots of, this might sound strange to people like us and some of the audience here, who do think about these questions, but I find that a lot of normal people living normal lives seem quite reluctant to look back on that period of lockdown. Maybe they don't like what the country became. So there's this kind of a tendency to black it out. But I agree, having that discussion, winning those arguments is essential. Okay, Matt, I have a question from Paul. This is really interesting. He says, is there any truth in the idea that those pushing net zero are defending their own vested economic interests and even manipulating resource allocation and public consumption habits? Or is net zero simply a sincere expression of the elite's anxieties about the future? That's really interesting, because you do hear both sides of that argument, that the net zero thing is being driven by a new elite that's got a vested interest in, you know, renewables, for example, or wants to just kind of puppeteer the public, and others who say that net zero actually does speak to a culture of fear in the establishment. Where do you fall on that argument?
Well, I think mostly people don't talk their own book. You know, they are convinced that it's a crisis, and they therefore both campaign for it and invest in the what they see as the solutions. But that does put them in awkward positions. You know, Dale Vince of Ecotricity has had huge subsidies from the taxpayer for his renewables business. And he is very, very vocal as saying we need more of them. That is a vested interest. You know, it's not illegal. It's just the way it is. And I do think one has to be aware of that. And on the whole, people on that side of the argument get much less criticism for their vested interests than people on the other side of the argument. So everyone's, you know, quickly onto you if you speak in favor of oil and you've got interest in oil. I used to have interests in coal in Northumberland. I was always meticulous in declaring them. I no longer do, by the way. But actually, I didn't argue in favor of coal. I argued mostly in favor of gas, which was coal's biggest rival. But nonetheless, I was still attacked relentlessly as somehow taking the position I did purely for my own self-interest. And that wasn't the case. So I'm prepared to grant that to other people too. I think they do genuinely believe what they want, but they ought to be a little more careful about declaring when they do have vested interests.
It's like as soon as you raise any critical perspective on lockdown or climate change or any other question, people will bark at you, who funds you? And I often feel like turning around and saying, well, who funds you? But I think you're right. You know, let's have the discussion on the normal plane of accepting that people believe what they're saying. And that's always a useful starting point. Okay, a question here from Andy. I guess this is about the standing of science more broadly. Is science and the funding of science now so compromised that proper research will suffer as a consequence, and proper research will become more difficult? I guess, how bad is the crisis of science, or how bad is the politicization of science, the exploitation of science by certain elements in society? Has that compromised it to a fatal degree, do you think?
Well, I think it is quite a big problem, yes. I think the degree to which really interesting discoveries will be made has been compromised, partly by the fact that a big chunk of the scientific world is now pursuing somewhat sort of woke angles on things, or green angles on things, rather than just seeing where the discoveries take you, partly because, as I say, there is this dogmatic funding of the things that people believe in and not funding their challengers. There's not nearly enough alternative sources of funding for maverick scientists, some of whom are going to be badly wrong, but some of whom may turn out to be very important. If I had one wish, it would be to decentralize the funding of science, to break it up into lots of rival streams, so that they start competing with each other rather than adhering to one dogma.
This is a question from Martin. You've touched on this already, but I wonder if you could elaborate. He asks, do you ever think we will get an adequate resolution to the lab leak questions? And he goes on to say, it seems that anyone who even raises these questions is labelled a conspiracy theorist. So I guess that comes back to the question of what's the possibility of cut through on this issue? Because it does sometimes feel like one is banging one's head against a brick wall. I'm sure you felt that more than most. Do you think there will come a point either that the dam breaks open and we have a proper open discussion, or that so much information comes to light that it just will become undeniable that we at least need to have this debate?
Yes, I think we will resolve this. It may take many more years, but I think at some point it will become clear what happened. After all, there may well be Chinese scientists who know pretty well exactly what happened. a year ago, next month, I was in Geneva and I managed to talk to George Gao, the head of the Chinese Centers for Disease Control at the time. And he made it pretty clear that it certainly wasn't the market and he couldn't rule out the lab. He wouldn't go any further than that. But, you know, the more we can open up to talk to people, the more will emerge. In the case of the Soviet anthrax incident that you mentioned, it took more than a decade before the truth finally emerged. It'll be very hard to keep this from emerging in the long run. But there are people who say to me, not only, oh, we'll never find out, so let's not bother. The new chief scientist to the UK government said that on the radio, said, look, there's no point in pursuing this because we may never know. That's a feeble excuse, in my view. But also a very senior scientist said to me, it's very important we don't find out. He said, I think you're probably right. It probably did happen in the lab, but it's very important that we don't find out. Would you say that after an airliner crashed? I said, of course not. And yet 20 million people are dead now, not 200.
This is an interesting one because this is an issue I don't know anything about, really, but I'm sure you do. This is a question from John. What is Matt's view on hydrogen and the hydrogen economy? Will the cell fuel ever explode onto the world market?
I'm very skeptical about hydrogen, principally because unlike methane, you can't dig it out the ground. You have to manufacture it. And in doing so, you need a lot of energy. So by definition, you are dealing with a very expensive fuel because you know, you're going to use up a lot of electricity or methane in making it. And the conversion efficiency is not 100%, so you're wasting some of that energy. So it's bound to cost more than the electricity or the methane in the first place. Besides which, it's a really difficult gas to handle. It can seep through almost anything. It explodes at the drop of a hat, etc., etc. It can be handled. It's a perfectly reasonable fuel to use in some situations. It's very, very lightweight, so ideal for spacecraft and things like that. But I don't think it's the answer to our problems, no.
Okay, Matt, here's the final question. This is from Alex. And he says, getting a handle on the climate and energy discussion by doing one's own research can feel overwhelming. I can attest to that myself. He says, can you recommend authoritative digests on climate change or things that people should read? So you don't have to give a long list of books and things that people should read, but it can feel overwhelming for people, I have no doubt, when they are bombarded with these sometimes quite hysterical claims and complicated data-driven information, which might not make sense suddenly, often doesn't make sense to me. Can you suggest what people should read, or perhaps even an approach to these questions that people might take in order that they don't feel so overwhelmed by what often seems to be scary information?
Yeah, no, it's a key point. And of course, the best information changes over the years. So, if I give one source now, it may not be the best one in next year, but almost any of Bjørn Lomborg's books are worth reading. Because they give a very balanced account of both climate and energy policy. The Global Warming Policy Foundation, I think, does a great job of showing the science in a skeptical light, which is vital, because you'll get plenty of mainstream media giving you the alarmist version. I think you can balance it by reading the GWPF publications. And I've summarized my view in various publications for them, including a lecture I gave in 2016, which I don't think I would change a word of to this day. As for the virus, I have to say you couldn't do better than going to our book Viral, but I'm sorry about that. That's me talking my own book.
I couldn't agree more. Everyone should read Viral. Matt Ridley, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brendan.